Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest National Language Access webinar from the Migration Policy Institute. My name is Chandasi Pandya, and I'm a policy analyst with MPI, and I'll be your moderator for the next hour. Today's webinar, Making It Work, Lessons in Collaborating on Language Access Contracting, features Neil Saxena and Simone Richardson of the Government of the District of Columbia. Before I introduce Neil and Simone, I wanted to take just a few moments to introduce MPI to those of you new to us and to also alert those of you who are familiar with us to some of the new additions to the Language Portal, our hub for all things language access. MPI is an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank based in Washington, D.C., dedicated to analysis, development, and evaluation of migration and immigrant integration policies at the local, national, and international levels. Within MPI, the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy serves as a unique crossroads for different stakeholders involved in immigrant integration to come together and discuss the challenges and opportunities presented by the field. And within the center, we have developed an online digital library and resource center for language access called the Language Portal. So the portal continues to be a premier online resource for language access practitioners seeking practical technical assistance in managing their translation and interpretation programs. We continue to add hundreds of new contracts, protocols, and sample translated materials to the portal, and have also recently included new original resources, including Practitioner's Corner articles on ensuring quality assurance in contracting and writing more effective requests for proposals for language services. Please also be on the lookout for a Practitioner's Corner from one of our speakers today, Neil Saxena, who will offer some tips and tricks to keep in mind when working with procurement officers on translation and interpretation contracting. So this webinar covers the important but often underemphasized issue of effective collaboration across government on language access. While different government offices may share the same end goal regarding the provision of translation and interpretation services, their starting points for obtaining vendors and managing the contracting process are different. On the one hand, government procurement offices process many different types of contracts for services, but often have standard rules, procedures, and approaches in place regardless of the type of service being contracted for. This is their method of ensuring quality control and minimizing contract costs. And on the other hand, government program offices are tasked with implementing and overseeing language access programs, but may not always have the tools, understanding, or input into the contracting processes to help develop and select the most effective vendors. The result is that in the absence of effective contracted language access services, limited English proficient communities may face inequities in access to reliable information and services. You know, and these divisions of responsibility between program and procurement offices can be seen across agencies, across the federal government, local government, agencies big and small. Yet as today's webinar will show, it doesn't have to be that way. Engaging in discussion and planning early and often across functions can hold the key to getting contracts to work better. As we'll hear from Washington, D.C., the government there has taken several steps to improve collaboration between program and procurement offices and to smooth the contracting process. Along the way, they've learned many lessons that can be a good example for those of you elsewhere in the country looking to ramp up your language access contracting. So without further ado, I'd like to turn it over to Neil Saxena, Grant Manager and Program Coordinator with D.C.'s Office of Asian Pacific Islander Affairs, and Simone Richardson, Contracting Officer with the D.C. Office of Contracting and Procurement. Neil will speak first, and then he will be followed by Simone. Neil?
Thank you, Tanasi, and thank you to MPI for providing us this opportunity to talk about some of the work that we are doing in the District of Columbia. First, I'd like to start by talking about language access in the district. Language access policy in the district first came about in the spring of 2000 when Mayor Williams launched his Asian and Pacific Islander Initiative. From that, through activism from the community and from the government, in 2004, the Language Access Act was passed. Language Access Act requires that district government programs, departments, and services assess the need for and offer oral language services, provide written translation of documents into any non-English language spoken by a limited or non-English proficient population that constitutes 3% of 500, which is ever is less, of the population serviced or encountered or likely to be serviced or encountered. The Office of Human Rights coordinates and oversees this to government programs, departments, and services in complying with the provisions of the Act. One of the unique aspects of this Act, as we're talking about collaboration, is that The Act also named the Language Access Coalition as a partner in the implementation of the Act. The Coalition is a group of community organizations who provide support in ensuring the Act is implemented at a high level. That's one of the collaborations that this Act sets forth. The other collaboration deals with what we call in the district constituent offices. The Office on African Affairs, the Office on Asian and Pacific Island Affairs, from which I am from, and the Office of Latino Affairs are the three consultative bodies to OHR in implementing this Act. Before I get into the actual contract, I wanted to give everyone a sense of what we've done around translation and interpretation in the district. Initially, when the Act was passed, OHR had developed a statement of work, and in that statement of work, it required vendors to have a quality control plan, and once they translated the documents or provided an interpretation, it would be sent to review with the consultative agencies, Office of African Affairs, Asian and Pacific Islander Affairs, and Latino Affairs. The three agencies put together a quality control mechanism, and that mechanism assigned a numerical score to translated documents, and what they covered were mistranslation, sentence flow, cultural competency, and then the overall flow. The two recommendations that were given were either the documents were sent back to the vendors or they were recommended for distribution. One of the issues with this is the documents, in terms of translation, were sampled. As far as interpretation, the same issue was it was a sampling. It wasn't all of the documents. And so what we had is a great variety within the quality of the documents as well as interpretation. So why do we decide on a citywide contract? Essentially, because what we were doing before wasn't as effective. Previous quality of translation interpretation was inconsistent because the documents in the quality control were sampled, and so the ones that were returned and fixed were done well, or the interpretations that were monitored could be corrected, but the others were not. So we felt that having a citywide contract, you could set a standard where there would be a minimum for all of the vendors to meet. And then the agencies, each agency would not have to set their own standard. Translation and interpretations from the vendors were varied also because of the issues with subcontracting, which often occurs with the different vendors. The other reason why we decided to do a citywide contract is it results, at least in the district, is having a less number of vendors, and we believe that the vendors would then be able to forge relationships with the agencies and improve their understanding of terminology and phrases. The last issue, which many of you may also see in your interpretation, had to deal with fonts. And this was a big issue, particularly with some of the African language and Asian language fonts, that we felt that we could include aspects in the citywide contract to address these issues. Now I would like to go over some of the items that we put into the citywide contract. So what we decided to do in a citywide contract was come up with a robust section within the contract that provided minimum quality measures for each vendor to meet in order to do business with the district around interpretation and translation. What we did is divide up the requirements into individual requirements and vendor requirements. Under individual requirements, we require interpreters must possess proof of credentials, be tested for accuracy, cultural awareness of intended audiences, and knowledge of client-specific and industry-specific terminology. We require the interpreters pass an assessment of language proficiency in both target and source language and receive continuous positive feedback on the quality of their work from the client and employer. We also require for translators and editors to, again, possess proof of credentials, be tested for accuracy, cultural awareness, and intended audiences, and knowledge of client-specific and industry-specific terminology, pass an assessment, receive continuous positive feedback. And the additional area that we included in here, which is different from interpreters, was that they have special, that some of them do specialize in the area of knowledge or field of practice, i.e. medical or legal or what have you. Those were the individual requirements. The other component was providing vendor requirements. What we did here is we outlined what we expect from their quality control plan. The expectation that we had is that they follow the steps that we outlined, which include that the initial translation, that it goes through some type of editing process. The next step would be a desktop publishing. What we found in talking to the vendors is this is often a misnomer. What we mean by desktop publishing is really just layout, ensuring that the target language text is in the same layout as the source language text. After the desktop publishing, we expected them to have an additional step of proofreading, and then finally the delivery to the clients. So what did we find from working in this partnership, and what we found was effective? How this worked is the three consultative agencies, as well as Office of Human Rights, met multiple times with the Office of Contracting and Procurement. What we found was it was important to build a relationship with the contracting officer and explain why we were including the various quality control mechanisms, identify where we got some of the requirements from, even identify some vendors who do meet these requirements. The other part that we found to take notice of is understand the limits within contracting. I think we had a lot of expectations and requirements, and we had to balance those with the restrictions and rules of contracting. And so we took some time to understand what those rules and regulations were. Within the contracting and developing the contract, in the legal sufficiency review, oftentimes what individuals put in from the program aspect sometimes may get removed. And so what we did at that point is made sure that we were part of the legal sufficiency review. And so after the contract was finalized and sent for legal sufficiency, we met with the lawyers to go over and clarify the intent of some of the items that we had included in there. We also felt that working with the vendors is something that was important, in that maybe the vendors don't have the full capacity to do everything or understand what our requirements are, and we met with the vendors and identified what the expectations are and what are the requirements, and provided suggestions on how they could achieve those. At the end of the day, our goal was to get high quality interpretation and translation to the residents of the district. And so we were open to meeting with vendors and working with the Office of Contracting and Procurement. And then I think the final item was to be open to all the stakeholders. A lot of times we had various stakeholders come in and ask different questions, maybe stuff that we didn't agree with. And so we had to find a way to balance all of the different voices that were coming in from the community, from the vendors, from the contracting side, from the legal department. And so what we did is go through and take time to meet with them, to correspond with them, and build a relationship so that we can all get onto the same page. Now I'd like to turn it over to my colleague from the DC Office of Contractor Procurement, Simone.
Hi, my name is Simone Richardson, and I'm a contracting officer with the District of Columbia Office of Contracting and Procurement. The process for me began in 2009, late 2009, and early 2010. I began meeting with the Office of Human Rights and having discussions about their statement of work, and we began to lay the groundwork for the solicitation. Our discussions led to the decision to have an IDIQ contract and have OCP be the contract administrator, because it was a very large contract and it would be widely used. 2001, OCP opened the solicitation in the form of an invitation for bid. And at our pre-conference meeting, we got a lot of kickback from the constituent offices. And the reason we got the kickback from the constituent offices is because they weren't included in the conversations that we were having with OHR. And from the stance of the community, the contract bundling would kick out a lot of the vendors that were in the community. We pulled the contract back, and we started having conversations with the constituent offices. And early on, we bumped heads a little bit, but it was a misunderstanding of, and a, basically me not totally understanding why this contract was so different. And what I had to come to realize is that even though I procure goods and services every day, this contract had different layers. So including in meeting with the constituent offices, I started meeting with the community. I went to a coalition meeting, and it was discovered that a lot of the reasons that the constituent offices had so many issues was that the work that they were receiving was of poor quality. And me being a contracting person in a program office, I understood that I could send out a request for service and receive it, but when it's translation and documents that I have no idea what the language is, I don't know that it's incorrect. And it wasn't until it got to the community that it was discovered that it was incorrect. So by discovering these different layers and having a better understanding of what the issues were, we talked more and we met more. And through the spring of 2011, really up until the fall of 2011, we met repeatedly. We ate, we met, we talked, we discussed. And the importance of this contract to have the college, the quality control measures in place was really important because we didn't want to get the same thing that we had been receiving over and over, and that was stacks and stacks of documents that weren't usable, that the district had used the taxpayers' monies to pay for. So the three different constituent offices, myself and OHR, we sat and we actually rewrote the statement of work, and we included, you know, different requirements, the credentials, the glossaries. We added everything in that was important to the constituent offices and eventually the community. The issue with legal sufficiency is they didn't understand, again, the needs of the community, just like I didn't understand. So, like Neil had spoken of earlier, when we started meeting with legal after we finalized the contract, they were included in the meetings. And some things that the lawyers were asking me that I couldn't explain, the constituent offices were there to explain, and everything was going smoothly, and we finally got a finalized product, and we reopened the solicitation in early 2012, and after compliance documents and everything was received, we were able to reissue good contract that had all the quality control measures that was needed from the constituent offices, OHR, and eventually the community. The lessons that we learned in this particular solicitation was that we had to gain appreciation that the contract had to address the needs of the constituents. We had to meet with the end users and understand the issues they encounter with translation and interpretation. And because it is a law, we have to provide these services for residents of the District of Columbia. And we have to maintain a sense of spirit and collaboration, which we still do today. We have issues. We still collaborate with each other. We talk them through, and we see whatever we can do to come up with a good solution.
Great. Thank you so much, Simone, and
You,
Neil, as well. You know, I think it's particularly interesting that the lessons you learned throughout this process involved making changes to the actual contracting process, but also to sort of the culture of collaboration between your two offices. And I think that's sort of a really important issue that, you know, isn't emphasized enough, I think, in the contracting world. So I'd like to now open up the floor for a Q&A period. But before I begin, I have a few introductions and some reminders for you all. First of all, Neil and Simone are joined by a few colleagues from BC Government who are available to answer your questions as well. We have with us Monica Palacio, Director of the Language Access Program at the District of Columbia's Office of Human Rights, as well as Stephanie Franklin, also with the Office of Human Rights. And also, just a reminder that if you'd like to ask a voice question, please press star one and we'll unmute your line. Please also continue to type in questions into the web chat box. We have some great ones coming in. So I'll start us off with one of the questions that was in the web chat box, and that's that after the quality assurance standards were in place and you did your first round of vendor selection, how did that go and how did your offices, how did your two offices work together to make that first round of selections? Neil, why don't you go first, and then Simone, please feel free to chime in.
Sure. So the first solicitation was sent out, and Simone actually put together, and I believe this is standard, a pre-bidders meeting where the vendors all had the opportunity to come in and meet with Simone in the Office of Contracting and Procurement. At that meeting, she invited the constituent offices, Office of African Affairs, Asian and Pacific Islander Affairs, Latino Affairs, and the Office of Human Rights, and we were able to provide them with specific answers to questions they had about the requirements. And for example, the issue they had with desktop publishing that I mentioned in my presentation, we clarified that that actually means layout. And so from there, the individuals would then have bidded on the contract, and the Office of Contracting and Procurement went through and vetted the bids, and we continued our collaboration where we, as consultative agencies, vetted the quality parts, the quality control parts of the contract. And so they did the initial vetting. From there, we did the final vetting and sent it back to the Office of Contracting and Procurement for a final decision. So I think throughout the process, all the way to the selection of the vendors, we were included almost as the subject matter experts around the quality control to provide the Office of Contracting and Procurement that knowledge base so a decision could be made to select the highest quality vendor. Simone, did you want to add?
Well, the only thing I would like to add is that after, because there are rules and regulations in the solicitation process and vetting the vendors, and we had to first find the vendors responsible. And once we found them responsible, we were able to send a different, we didn't actually send the names of the vendors. We just sent the quality control documents that was requested to the agencies for review. So that's kind of how we vetted the first round.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. We have a voice question.
Yes, my question is, are you or are anyone listening in development of smartphone applications to do the interpretations when you're meeting face-to-face?
This is Neil Saxena. We are not in development of any smartphone applications. With regards to face-to-face, in the district, what we use is telephonic interpretation. And so currently, in the field, there are agencies that provide interpretation using the phone, using telephonic interpretation, and that's, you know, calling a number and requesting an interpreter, and then either most likely then using speakerphone to provide that interpretation.
Hi, this is Simone Richardson with the Office of Contract and Procurement, and even though we haven't, that's really a good idea, especially with FaceTime in terms of translating and face-to-face interpretation, that's really a good idea, and I'm sure it will be soon.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the use of technology is always, it's always tempting, but there are so many limitations in it that, you know, I think these quality assurance standards, which I'll be sure to pass around along with the webinar audio and slides, really, you know, really try to highlight the limitations of technology, but also obviously the obvious benefits of having technological resources when doing translations. Somebody else on the web chat forum was asking who helped establish the standards outside of DC government. Were there translators or interpreters that were consulted, or was the DC Language Access Coalition consulted as you sort of considered what a good vendor would look like?
This is Simone Richardson. We did. We did confer with the Language Access Coalition.
And Neil, did you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, and actually, in the initial research, I believe, and someone can maybe touch upon this a little bit more, is she contacted other jurisdictions to find out what they were doing. In terms of developing the actual requirements, these were based off of, one, our experience working with vendors, and two, I actually was able to find a lot of these quality control mechanisms just from a simple Google search of different vendors, and they had all of these components in there. And so that's a little bit about how we came about it. You know, there are vendors out there that have listed the components that we have required within their quality control plans. Till this point, we didn't find a whole host of vendors within the district or the district area who were providing these or had submitted this type of quality control plan. So we felt that if we identify what we expect, the vendors can then submit the plans to us. And in terms of other interpreters or translators, I guess throughout the experiences of all of the different offices, we've met with different interpreters and different translators and different companies and have noted all of their feedback and experiences and included that within the requirements.
I'd just like to add that what I found in looking at the different jurisdictions and even GSA's vendors was that the best practices that they followed were that they left the onus of the quality control to the vendors, which is something that we decided we wouldn't do, and we were going to add those requirements in the contract.
And I think that's an incredibly sort of important step that the government has taken in that regard. So I have a question here that's not necessarily related to the contract, but that is directed at the DC government language access program in general, and it relates to the testing and training of employees. Several of the web chat participants are asking if you have any resources to share or if you have any processes in place for testing and training bilingual employees. To answer that, we have Monica Palacio here.
Good afternoon. This is Monica Palacio, Director of the Language Access Program, and there are several answers to that question because on the one hand, we don't have a district-wide certification process for a bilingual employee. In many cases, there are agencies such as the Metropolitan Police Department that set up their own certification programs so that bilingual employees, we know what level of expertise they bring in the native language, but we do not have a district-wide system for doing that. What we do have is personnel with the title bilingual specialist in many cases, and these are individuals that in their role, in their job description, are expected to speak a second language and are, you know, proficient in that language, but again, we don't have a universal or standard way of identifying what level of proficiency they bring.
Great. Thank you for that. Another sort of interesting question relates to the sort of credentialing standards that are in the quality assurance standards.
Mm-hmm.
How, in your research and looking at how other agencies or regional governments have done in terms of looking for credentialed translators or interpreters, what did you find in your research on that?
Found that most of the other jurisdictions don't require credentialing. A lot of the credentialing information I found was basically by Googling. And I don't have the contract in front of me, so I don't really want to misquote anything, but
okay.
Yeah.
And I think I just want to add, one of the issues that we found is for certain languages, we found that there may not be credentialing. And so in the contract, we do allow for experience, and we have specific requirements for either individuals who are providing language services. If there is no, for example, testing in that language, there's alternatives that person can still provide the service. And so we were aware of those issues. The languages that are most prevalent we provide language support for are obviously Spanish. we provide in the Asian languages, Chinese, Vietnamese, and Korean. And we're seeing Bengali and Urdu as emerging languages. And for the African immigrant languages, we have seen Amharic and French and some other languages that may be also emerging. And so we do appreciate that not every language has a credentialing or testing or an official testing or certification. And so we've included those components within the actual contract. And honestly, I'm not sure if the contract will also be available to everybody, but we can provide that as well.
And I'd like to just add that what we did find also around credentialing is that it varies by jurisdictions because there's a lot of different listings of them. And we kind of went on the contractor side back and forth of where if we were going to leave that in the contract, and we decided to leave it in because in today's times, everybody has to have some type of certification. And then you have the legal and the medical, and because they had to have different and other certifications that they got paid more. So that was something that we really kind of went back and forth with.
Okay, great. So another question that's come up a couple of times now is whether there are tools available for testing the cultural appropriateness of translations and interpretations, and if so, what did D.C. government use?
I think Neil, he put in a list of mechanisms that they would have to adhere to for the testing, and it's in a contract. It's in section.
And I think the cultural appropriateness testing is on the vendor to test the individuals who are providing the service, so we are not testing them. This is a requirement of the vendor, and so they do have testing. We have not gone in and looked at what exactly the specific testing is, but they do have a testing within each vendor, and they are required to send that the results of the test when they submit their list of interpreters and translators and editors to us. So we don't actually do the testing and the credentialing and all of that. That's all done by the vendor. And the expectation we have is they send us all the results of that.
Okay, great. And another question coming in, somebody would like to know if the Plain Language Act applies to translations and interpretations in contracts. The Plain Language Act, as far as I understand, is just, it's an act to help translate a lot of the bureaucratic speak into lay language so that it's easily understood by the community. And I think with respect to translations and interpretations, I guess this person is probably asking if there are steps in the review process to make sure that the vendors that you're seeking sort of know how to translate bureaucratic speak into more communicative language.
Will bureaucratic be legal?
Yeah, like legalese.
Well, then, yes.
And so that's just a part of the process that you use.
Yes.
Hi, this is Stephanie Franklin from the D.C. Office of Human Rights. I do know that at least one vendor that we use under this contract does have certain mechanisms in place for the Spanish language around ensuring that it is plain language that is used, say, format a document or take it from one language to another specifically for Spanish. And I remember that being part of a presentation that that they gave in front of all of the D.C. government agencies that use this contract. So I am certain for the Spanish language that that's being taken into consideration. But for other languages, I'm not sure what the capabilities of the vendors are in regard to the Plain Language Act.
And so this is another question more about sort of how D.C. government does things. So once a vendor provides a translated, document back to you all, do you have any sort of internal procedures for double-checking the translations? Are there focus groups that you use or other mechanisms?
This is Monica Palacio, the Director of the Language Access Program, and I would say that we are in the process of transitioning from former vendors to the current vendors, and what we're planning to do in the next 3 to 6 months is do spot checks of documents that have been translated so that we can check each vendor with each agency at least once in terms of a written translation. And we also want to set up a mechanism to do some quality control with interpretation. But we would need in place something like a panel of interpretation and translation experts that would really lend their expertise, because we are more, you know, in the program and policy side, and we are not fluent in these languages. So it's important for us to bring in outside experts to do that, and we're in the process of figuring that out.
Thank you. Thank you, Monica. Somebody else was curious about how you've measured vendor quality of interpreters, I guess because interpreters have different accents or, you know, different dialects within a particular language. Was there any way to sort of control for those differences in speech?
I think this was, and that's an excellent question, and for translation, it's a lot more straightforward to do a quality control check. For interpretation, this was an area that we spent a good amount of time in identifying how we can do a quality control check and not exhaust resources. And by meaning exhaust resources is having a live person at each interpretation to check and do all of that. And so, like Monica said, there is going to be the spot checking. The other component of that is, usually in the district, if an agency is putting on some type of event, workshop to a particular community, the luxury that the district has is we have three offices who are often invited to those events who can provide feedback on the interpretation. And then within our quality control mechanism, we've included that the vendors are required to get feedback from the end users of the interpretation on if they understood what was going on, if their questions were being answered. You know, they wouldn't be able to tell if the interpretation was being done correctly from English to target language, but they would be able to identify if maybe stuff was being summarized or they weren't sure of the terminology. The interpreters weren't sure of the terminology being used. And then, so I think that's kind of where we've tried to put in some measures for quality within interpreters. Also, the other thing is that each agency has a glossary of terms that they commonly use. There's a requirement that glossary be provided to both translators and interpreters. And so that should help them in providing the interpretation. And then the final thing is, and this is more about just ethics, that they're all required to, you know, follow a code of ethics. And so those are kind of some of the components that we have in for interpretation. But it is a little more difficult to verify all of the interpretation compared to translation. And I don't know if anyone else wants to add to that.
I just wanted to add the fact that we had discussed this, and this is part of why we wanted to have the vendors in the program offices build relationships so that if an interpreter is better in a particular language, that the agencies would know, you know, who they could which of the vendors that they could contact for a particular language, and the fact that the languages are steadily growing in the District of Columbia. So that's why it's really important to have relationships with the vendors.
Great. Thank you for that. So I have one last question here and a last call for anybody who wants to ask a voice question. Please press star one to get in line. And this question relates to the use of video remote interpreting. I don't know if any of your vendors use that right now in District of Columbia. And if they do, are there any sort of protections in place for privacy, and how does that work, and where have you sought guidance for that?
I think our interpretation needs are based off of the agencies, and maybe Monica can add some more to this. But to this point, I believe the primary uses of interpretation have been face-to-face and telephonic. I don't believe there has been a demand, or if there is, it's a very low demand for video interpretation from the agencies. And so I know vendors who are on this contract, some of them do provide it, but we don't in the district have experienced a need for it at this point.
I would agree with what you stated, Neil. Nothing else to add.
Okay, great. And we have one last voice call.
This is more a comment in regarding the plain language for translation. And I believe it needs to come from the source language. So I would think that the individuals that write the documents to be translated either through policy or the publication office have a big role in providing the plain language. So the translation company or the translator has to do their true job, which is translate what is for the end user, taking into consideration the plain language as well in the target language.
Thank you for that. I think, you know, that's an excellent point and clarification. And for those of you who may not have been able to hear Chu saying that the responsibility for plain language resides in the person or organization that writes the original language document. And so, yeah, I think that's a great clarification. If there isn't anything else, we're going to just end a little bit early. Thank you to Neil and Simone, Monica and Stephanie for coming and answering our questions and sharing a little bit about how they're making collaboration work and making their language access contract work in the District of Columbia. If you have any questions for me that you didn't get a chance to ask or any questions for our speakers that you didn't get a chance to ask, please feel free to email me at cpandya@migrationpolicy.org. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.
For more information and to access past language access webinars, please visit www.migrationpolicy.org/languageportal.